I've just been told very, very recently that my ultimate goal has been achieved by someone else, basically Palestinian people. So in some different ways. So actually, maybe I should go back and study that thing instead of doing this talk, but I'm already here. So so further, I just present you the line of thought that I'm pursuing. The idea of going to Sweden, of course, is just because it's simplicity. As we all know, the massive gravity seems to have this formidable problem that always occurs there and things like that. So the obvious idea is that since in 3D, gravity is way much simpler, that it's just a pure gig theory. The hope was to learn something about why massive gravity is so hard to do. Because even though gravity is so much simpler, doesn't have any propagating degree freedom in 3D, but the usual difficulty of massive gravity remains there in 3D. Right? So at the near level, you still have to stick to polyfields combination, and if you go to the mean level, still run into the problem of stability. So that's why. The point of the gravity becomes simpler in 3D is to use the so-called first order formulation. So the first part of my talk is briefly go through this and actually apply this to the massive gravity. So the first part is the first order formulation. As we all know, the ingredient you need is this delta one term is defined to be this, and this major key menu we assume is diagonalized dimension. And also the ingredient is another ingredient is the connection, and that's as usual it's usually one bit. It is just a connection on a tensor path on a tangent bundle, and usually it's required to be metric compatible. And this formula then just means it's anti-symmetrical. And it has to be torsion free. In non-Einstein theory, and in this form, it just means that this is also usually written as external covariance relative on the if that is satisfied, then it's a combination with connection. And that's the usual connection with your Einstein theory. And of course, there is also Riemann tensor. So these are the ingredients, and of course the as usual the connection. The action in 3D is very simple. The Einstein-Hilbert action can just be written as this. And in 4D, you just add another delta into it. And then what's interesting about the first order formulation is that, as well now, that if now you can treat the delta and add the connection with independent variables by themselves. So if you vary the action, just vary the action with respect to the connection, gives you the partial free condition for free. And so from the beginning, you only need to assume the connection to be much compatible. And it turns out the torsion free condition comes out as a consequence of the equation motion. And then we get the action with respect to the values gives you the Einstein equation. I still feel a little bit puzzled actually why this worked out so nicely. So in this form, the first order formalism and the metric formalism, the usual metric formalism much quicker, at least classically, because because you get the initial data connection for free. In 3D, this Einstein equation, what do you get? Suppose, I call, of course, your cosmology constant, which is simply just a water form, of course, multiplied by a constant. And so the equation of motion you get, I'm not going to be very careful with the coefficient here, so as long as it can be scaled arbitrarily, I'm just being a little bit careless with it in this talk. I'll read like this. And it's a little bit, it's equivalent to the Einstein equation, but it's not, you know, if you look at it at first glance, it doesn't seem to be quite like the Einstein equation. If you do that for a 4D, you immediately get the Einstein equation. If you take the quantity of that result, and you get Einstein cancel out of it immediately. But in 3D, you don't, because this is nothing, but this is Riemann cancel. And if you write down the components, this equation actually contains four indices. So naively, we think this seems to be too strong because Einstein equation only constrains Richard tensor rather than Riemann tensor. And usually, Riemann tensor contains more degrees of freedom than Richard tensor. But precisely in 3D, it works because in 3D, Riemann tensor and Richard tensor are algebraically related as it is well known. And so this equation, it turns out, precisely is equivalent to the Einstein equation. So for example, I like to write the Einstein, the Ricci tensor. Okay. Let me just give you a So in precisely in 3D, the Richard tensor and Riemann tensor are related as this. And here, what do I mean by RA? It's just RAP and CB. And R is just the Richard correction. So it's the trace of the Richard tensor. And I define RA as a one form, let's get it like this. And I forgot to mention that all whenever two forms are adjacent to each other, I assume it's a wedge product. So it's a wedge product. And so you can see this effect is identity in 3D. And similarly, I can define my Einstein tensor this way. And again, G is just a trace of Einstein tensor. Because Einstein tensor and Richard tensor are algebraically related. And so I could rewrite this relation equals to so the Riemann tensor and Einstein tensor in 3D is related this way. So if now you remember the Einstein equation simply says this is Einstein equation in 3D. Well, this is general. And so in 3D, you find Einstein equation is just getting there. Like this. That's precisely what you get if you have a reaction with respect to the Bell. Now I go through this because I want to talk about the massive gravity. So I just want to rewrite this equation slightly when I include the Pauli Fields mass term here. And the Pauli Fields mass term. So now I'm going to the massive one, massive case. So the Pauli field mass term usually is written as a particular combination. In the equation of motion, that's the additional term to have. where we have introduced a background metric. That's the metric perturbed around. And then the metric perturbation actually is the full metric minus the background one, and we usually assume it's small. So to the leading order, this is the, well, it is only known to the leading order, and that's taking that combination. And the background is assumed to satisfy the background Einstein equation. And I just want to mention that the choice edge usually is written as the contraction of h meaning with respect to the background metric. But of course, I only care about it to the leading order, and so it makes no difference to just put the full metric in here. Right? To the leading order difference is the subleading. And so I can equally well put using the full metric. And similarly, this term, h gamma mu mu, to leading order, it makes no difference if I just put a form metric in there. So I, rather than just put a form metric in there, I make no difference between the two, between these two. If I do that, then the Einstein equation with the Maxton added in there, you in the language of the form metric, can be just written this way. Now this is the full Einstein tensor. So it contains the leading order that satisfies the background, and then the first order is going to be satisfied by the perturbation of this term and by the Maxton F. Okay. The reason I do that, of course, is because I want to, right, as use my notation here, I didn't know. This equation then becomes equivalent to this. And again, what do I mean by HA? It means HAB times EB. And what do I mean by HAB? It's just the usual thing. You just lower the trade the Greek indices to Latin indices using the relevant matrices. So that's just the Einstein equation with the polyfield Maxton editing. So now I use the relation that Riemann tensor and Einstein tensor are related this way. I can write my Einstein equation with Maxton edit in there to be just this. So here I find a pleasant accident, namely the trace edge disappears in this equation. So this trace appears in the polyfield combination, and it disappears in this final form. It seems to be pleasant to me because what I was hoping to find is if I can write something that, if this perturbed equation can be easily integrated, then I will naturally find the nonlinear completion. It used to be that the trace of actually is something that's a little bit difficult to interpret in matrix.
You're still in Greek.
Yes.
So is there a covariant action principle that equation comes from? You seem to be relying very much on the split between the background and the first and the distortion.
That's right.
And I'm not sure.
You want a core action that gives rise to this equation.
Yes.
That's what I was hoping to find. I haven't been able to. That's good. You want a core action?
I mean, I think it seems, if it's not known, I would conjecture it doesn't exist. Because if the original, the theory without the mass term has no local degrees of freedom.
That's
a consequence of the gauge invariance. So if you want to have a mass turbine, as it looks like grab spin two modes with masses, then either you're going to violate the gauge invariant, in which case you don't have a covariant action, or the gauge invariance is going to work throughout and is going to make that second term meaningless. Am I reasoning wrong? If the second term has a covariant completion, then there's some dynamics.
That one makes it trivial.
But
I haven't been able to.
You mentioned there was some paper by Downs and et al. Right. Seemed to write some kind of action.
I haven't been able to study only very recently, but they have some high order solution terms, R squared terms, and they somehow argue. I don't know.
To get something like this out.
If you expand the equation along linear diagram, they can get a polynomial combination.
They get precise.
Okay.
Really? They get precise.
That's the answer.
At a linear order, they claim they get precisely polynomial.
They have a covariant action. They have a covariant action, first of all.
Sure.
Or the combination of R squared terms.
Mm-hmm.
They show that the
if you expand it without around flat background
But does the counting degrees of freedom still tie in that number for the degrees of freedom?
Sorry?
No, they claim they have
to not in the R plus R squared, right?
So therefore it's an R plus R squared, which is not covariant?
No, it's covariant.
It's not topological.
It's covariant.
Right, but the issue is that the topologicality is just a question of counting.
R squared, if you put f of r something, then you actually expect the theory in general to have an exascalar degree of freedom.
Yeah.
If the equation is 40, no middle. So presumably that's this scalicity. Well, let's wait to see, but basically I think he probably wants to tell us it's not just for the equations, but what the spectral decomposition of the propagating mode is.
But their equations are not 40.
Probably this still must not have real scalicity.
Their equations are not 40.
Which is you are not what?
Not fourth order, the equation second order. That's why it says.
So I'm just very confused because in first order formalism, it's just a counting of the gauge morphism subtracted from the zero.
Some of the residual gauge minimization is not normal. They're not redundancies in the usual sense because the constraint equation. I think the answer is the constraint equation must become second order in derivatives.
So it's not a constraint equation.
It's not a constraint equation, it's an actual equation of motion.
Okay, let's see.
Can I ask a question?
Third half of the times 2 + 1 gravity. So what we show is topologically massive 2 + 1 can be converted into poly fields. We prove that.
They claim it's not just a topological one, because topological one can take only one perpetual degree B. Their paper, they claim there are two, which is precisely massive spin two. So they say the topological one is all of the square root of the zero. I don't completely understand it.
Sorry, can I ask something here? Some point I haven't understood. The DHAs are one formed, aren't they?
Yeah, they're one formed. Yeah, they define.
So in the last equation there, when you have HA times EB, is that a wedge product?
Yeah.
Yes, everywhere is wedge
product. But H mu nu is a symmetric matrix.
H mu nu is, but HA is one form. That's precisely why I cannot make a two form.
Yes, but then he wedges it with EB. Why is that not zero?
No, because I'm not contracting here.
That's wedge.
If I'm contracting, then I would have trouble. But if I I cannot contract EA here, then that will vanish. But here, then nothing is contracting.
No, he's writing it. I probably missed something obvious.
No, this is not zero, of course, because otherwise you won't have any mass.
I don't know.
You don't have product here. So now I'm at with only HA, which seems to be a little bit, good news. And that's precisely the polyfield combination that makes it happen. If it's not one here, anything else, you won't find the trace disappears in the final form. So I had hoped that was something good, but it doesn't really pan out very well. That's because what do I mean by HA? HA is given by this one. And remember, HAB is essentially just a perturbation of mu mu multiplied by these two matrices. And so you can work out what HA is and just give you the result. HA is just the variation of the well and the bell lines plus additional piece. So this term is very nice because it immediately integrate. So you know what the full nonlinear thing should be. It just should be the variation of the value, that's all. But the second term doesn't integrate. And so that still is a problem. So this term is not nice. That's my difficulty using. Okay. So the second term over there is not nice. If only, however, if only this thing is actually symmetric, I call this a wishful thinking. Because I have been hoping for it for a while and until I gave up, because it generically is not true. But if this is true, then the second piece becomes delta EA again. So with this condition, actually it's nothing but this. And if that, however, in that case, the theory is actually turned out to be not so exciting. Because then if you write on it for theory, you find what happens is nothing. But a usual Einstein theory with additional constant external source, which can be tuned to be, you know, to match your cosmological constant, so that in particular this condition is satisfied. Actually, if you look, it seems to be sort of very ad hoc. In fact, this is satisfied as long as the background metric and the variation is diagonal. And so in that case, in fact, that includes almost any, include lots of interesting cases we used to talk about. For example, we say with a Nestor added in there, and then for any huge cosmological constant, you can find the best solution because you can tune, you know. And that's precisely the example where this thing happens. And you know why from this language that you can cancel the cosmological constant. It's just basically, if you do that, you just add a background source. So again, it's not very interesting. So my major problem now cannot go really much further than this, is that I do not know how to naturally nonlinearly compute this actually in this equation. But of course, this talk is about trying to understand Einstein theory in 3D using the fact it can be written as a gauge theory. So the second part of it, I'll just talk about a little bit about this thing. I call it Chern-Simons Broca because it has similarity to the Broca theory. Because reason to do that, of course, is because 3D gravity, as we all know, at least classically, is equivalent to some Chern-Simons theorem. And so the hope is, if you understand, if you well, just to start this Chern-Simons theory, see if you can help to understand why massive gravity is here. So can we write mass term in Chern-Simons theory? Of course we can. In fact, this has been studied by many people before. And in particular, if you have a Chern-Simons action like this, of course you also have, if it's nonlinear, you have more. And then you can just add mass term most naively. It looks very naive, but that actually works. This has been studied by Desser and Joachim and people before a long time ago, and they actually thought theory like this is actually equivalent to the so-called logically massive gauge theory. The propagate 1 degree freedom, and the theory is actually healthy. But that's not something that I'm interested, at least not in here, because obviously the theory great character at least, and that kind of pattern in quantum theory. So my question, natural question is, And for the reason that's becoming clear very soon, is what if I have two copies of transaminin? I need to do a little bit more effort.
Another blackboard over there.
Yeah, which also requires some force to put it on. If I have two copies of transaminin here, let me speak for a tritium-helium case for the synthetic. And imagine I'm looking at the theory, I have two state fields with two transaminins turning, with a minus sign in the case. The minus sign is very important for my construction to at least have any hope to work, even though it didn't. I need a minus sign for it. And now, imagine I just add the mass term not for A, nor for A need for B, but for the difference of the two. And you see there's a minus sign here, and there is a minus sign here. Those both are the minus forces. So if I just look at the equation of motion, it's very simple. Just as F A equals okay, minus M star A minus B equals F B. And you see here, you see why I need a minus sign, because if there's a minus sign here, so if I vary the action with respect to A, I just get A and this term. But if I vary the action with respect to B, I get a minus sign here, but then also I have a minus sign here.
Is this notation star means you have a background action?
That's right. In this case, then because of the gauge theory, I can change to just that. That's important. Yes. Okay, it's good that you point out them, but I don't lose all the gauge invariants. I keep one, which is diagonal. That's
sure.
That's it. I have a
finish.
That's right. So I break one of the gauge invariants. Yes, I do lose general. Okay, so now the consequence that FA equals FB in the abelian case is really simple, because the simplest that A difference between A and B is a pure gauge. So the consequence of it just simply says the difference between A and B is a pure gauge. So now the equation of motion really, the mass doesn't really matter in this passage right now, reads like this. And now I can use the Bianchi identity, namely BFA equals zero. Let me not to be here. So using Bianchi, I just immediately find basically just that's it. And if I write down the component form, this is just half sine equals zero. So that's the propagating degree freedom. So the result is that the theory contains 1 degree of freedom propagating.
So why A minus B is a pure gauge? Is it total?
Because the curvature equal. In the Abelian case, that immediately implies A minus B is a pure gauge.
But there's a star on it. That star doesn't matter. A minus B seems to be the star of it.
Yeah, that's why you have a star here.
No, I
but the curvature equal. Tells you A minus B is defined. Right?
Local.
Right? Yeah, it's local. Yeah. Assuming I'm not sure. Okay. So that means here, so that's precisely the star here is important, because otherwise you don't get the correct equation. So that's precisely the 1 degree freedom propagating. And in fact, if you look at the how this equation, this degree freedom comes about, it's identical almost. So I can name it's almost identical to the Stoker group. in programming. Let me try to remember how the Stokhover field, the equation logical Stokhover field, comes about in the Proc theory. It's almost identical to this, except they are equivalent in the case that this part A equals zero. Because in the Proc theory, you actually find additional piece, which is basically this, but you can choose the gauge, because in the Stokhover field theory, in the Proc theory, the gauge symmetry remains there, and so you can go into this gauge. In my case, I can still go into this gauge, even though I bring all the gauge symmetry, one of the gauge symmetry, but I have a diagonal gauge symmetry that remains. So I'm also allowed to go into this gauge. So if I do go into this gauge, the two theory seems to be completely equivalent. Of course, now that there remains a question to ask whether this addition degree field is physical subject. And that can be done for the linear case very easily. The theory, of course, if you look at these actions, are going to be bounded from below. But the point is, it's just like the massive topologically massive gravity gate theory. The same thing happens there. Namely, if you naively look at the actions not bounded from below, but there is constraints to take into account. Because there is non-propagating degree freedom that behaves more or less like a Lagrange multiplier. So if you take care of all the constraints, you solve the constraint, put back into the action, and you express your action purely in terms of the propagating degree freedom, there you find that the theory is actually bound from the and there's no ghost. In this case, because it's a union, it's very simple. So basically have 2 degree freedom and then try to dimensionalize it, and you find the same thing happens. So in this theory, as long as m is bigger than 0, there is no ghost. Okay, I've said a lot about this, but actually, this is completely trivial. And why is that completely trivial? Because I have only 1 degree freedom. So if there's only 1 degree freedom, you can always make it not a ghost, because if it is a ghost, happen to be a ghost, just give a minus sign to the total action and you clear the problem. Right. So if there's only one propagating degree of freedom, you can always make the theory happen. And that's not very surprising. But it will be then conceivable that the problem will happen, will arise in the non-abelian case, because there you will have multiple degrees of freedom and they could possibly run into conflict with each other. Because my goal is to look at the gravity, so I do have to worry about the non-abelian case. Because only then it will be interesting. So the whole non-abelian case, again, consider two copies of transcendent theory. Only there, transcendent theory is slightly more complicated, right? Because it's trace A via A plus 2 over 3 A triple A. Okay, other than that, there's not much difference. So imagine I have 2 gate here, and we're looking at the action. Again, we don't mind some here. And again, I just naively put the mass term for the difference of the 2 here. And I just write out equation motion. So the consequence of it, actually, the equation motion is almost identical. It's not almost, it's just identical. As you can see, because varying the transcendental term just gives you the courage. Okay. So that's very very easy to see that the equation motion function. So the complexity comes really counting that the condition of A equals FB in the non-abelian case is not the same. It just means now, apart from the non-trivial topology, let me assume I don't care about those. In fact, that was kind of interesting because now the monopoles, if there is any, can solve my additional degree of freedom, which can actually be a more interesting situation. But let me ignore that case, that situation, and just assume there's no such a thing. That B, well, okay, that's actually included in this case. The fact that it was FB means A and B differs by just the gate transformation. And this U is that. And U is operating written as the pion field, where TA is the gauge element. right? And often, the second term, the other left-hand side of the equation, it also can be written as the covariant derivative of this exponential. Now, again, I have
plus one gravity, and no propagating modes.
Right. That is because you don't have this term, you know, it's just topological.
As soon as you put in the mesh, you can get them.
That's right. Then you can
stop
hope
propagating.
To find right probability densities. And so again, now I have Yonke identity. Okay, just write that. So now the consequence of equation motion status. FB equals U, DBU, minus R with a star. Now you then just even ignore the mass thing. That doesn't give me. So the Yonke identity, is still there, and the consequence of that is just, okay, now I can ignore even B. And you see, exactly, this is identical to the Stokoe equational motion of the Stokoe field. In Proca theory, in the non-linear Proca theory, again, in the gate, D star B. And again, because I have a diagonal gate symmetry, I can't go into that case. And precisely in that case, the theory looks almost identical to the Fourier theory. Now, naively, I would imagine this theory propagate in how many degrees of freedom is going to be the dimension of the gauge group, that many degrees of freedom. And in the case of gravity, it will be 3 degrees of freedom. So now, if I recall the polyphias mass and gravity. On the flat background, it propagates at the linearized order, it propagates 2 degrees speed. If the cosmological constant is non-zero, then on the d theta background or anti-d theta background, you will have additional degrees freedom, which is 3, which adds to the total degree freedom becomes 3. In the d theta background, there is a lower bound for the mass, which is called the Kikuchi bound. Below that bound, you have a ghost. Above that bound, all 3 degrees freedom are fine. In EDS diagram, all the 3 degrees freedom are healthy as long as its mass square is larger than 0. So indeed, in EDS diagram, we do have 3 degrees freedom, which seems to match to this number here. Because indeed, in gravity, the gauge group will be SL2R as 3 generators. So that again is hopeful that there is some similarities at least between the 2 here. Again, now you remain, as I said, there's a question. How about if the theory has ghosts or not? That's one question. And 2, what kind of mass signal does it really cover? Which means, how the theory organize this massive model? Sorry.
5 minutes.
Enough, I think. All right, so these are 2 answers. And you find, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention one very important thing here, actually. When I say A and B equals this, that doesn't mean that it's not sufficient condition to make sure F A equals M B. Because it's a non-linear theorem, unfortunately. Gauge condition only tells you FA and FBE are the same apart from gauge condition. So it's only covariant. Okay. So in this case, this condition is only true if I also impose the additional condition that they commute. Okay. Only when they commute, you will get guaranteed FA equals MB, FB. And this, in fact, is very much similar to what Dazer and JP found in the logically massive gate theory, where we found similar constraint for the non-linear case. You have to consider this, but you have to solve this constraint. And it's a very complicated thing. And in their paper, they said you do not attempt to solve this constraint of gate theory. So I chose to do the same thing in my talk here. So I'm going to just ignore this additional constraint. Okay, so that's all. Okay, so now that tells you why it is so difficult to understand whether the theory has growth or not, because you have many constraints to worry about. You have to really solve all the constraints present back into vacuum and rewrite the theory in terms of the pure propagating degree freedom, and that's not an easy job. In fact, now I'm trying to cheat and try to answer this question by cheating. By that I mean I'm going back to the gravity theory. At least I'll try to answer that in the case when it has a gravity similarity. So now, in the last part of the talk, I'm combining the two things. So the gravity, because here there are two copies of Simon theory, and the reason I chose to do that is because the 3D gravity, with negative cosmology constant, namely, now I'm trying to do that on the ADS diagram. It's precisely two copies of Simon theory with a minus sign in between. Where you have A plus A minus is related to the usual thing in the following way. That is A plus, the speed generator, and A minus is the difference between the two. And this TA are the gate generator of SL2. Okay. And so you can treat A plus A minus as completely independent variables because I can treat omega and E as completely independent variables. If I do that, it's just a two copies to some theory precisely with a minus sign. In principle, you can have any plus any other sign in the first order formula, it makes no difference. But somehow in Einstein theory, it happens to be a minus sign in between. That seems to be a very happy, pleasant coincidence. So now I'm just naively asking master for the difference of the two. Again, here, I need a pleasant coincidence. That is, A plus minus A minus is precisely this guy. Is precisely 2 over EL times EA, TA. In other words, it doesn't involve OA, which means I'm still guaranteed that my first order formalism will be equivalent to the natural formula. Because if I vary omega first, I still get Gaussian plane condition. Okay? So I'm guaranteed that the bridge between transcendent theory on the gauge theory side and the usual gravity theory, the bridge is not broken. If I add anything here that has, you know, has omega in there, generically, I will break the equivalence between the two, and then the whole thing here falls apart. So here, I seem to have a very nice coincidence, precisely there's a minus sign, which is precisely the sign I want to have. Okay? So now this theory is, of course, identical to this one now, only with a gauge group SL2. Okay? So, finally, I come back to the very important thing about how to start. And as Leah just already mentioned, that to define Hochstar, you need to choose a metric of the metric. And before this, I never really talked about the metric, except that at the beginning of the talk, I said we usually assume metric is given by this. Now, in the normal GR, you can do that because the theory is a topological theory. The metric never enters the action. So you can, you know, it's just in the back of your mind that you choose the metric to be this. It doesn't have to be. And basically, the theory doesn't know anything about the metric. The moment I put the Hochstar in there, I do have to choose a metric now. And the metric cannot depend on the valence. Because if that depends on the valence, I screw my variational principle, because when I vary the action, I have to vary the norm. Not only the field, but also vary the chain, you know, the Hochstar, the definition Hochstar. And so here, I have to, I'm forced to choose the background region, which is fixed, which that I don't vary it, so I choose the background values. And it somehow is, you know, it's not terribly bad, because if I want to match up onto the polyfield massive gravity, there you also have a background match. So this seems to be precisely a most natural position where a background match should enter the picture. So now if I do assume I choose that background, then I assume that the background, okay, I don't need background anymore, if I choose a background, which is given like this, then I assume that the four delphines are not so far from the background metric, so I can do at least perturbation. I can, okay, just one more. So the reason gravity makes things simpler in this case seems to be is because now I can do a different variation principle. Instead of varying this theory with respect to A plus and A minus separately, as I get over there, which leads to a complicated theory, I can now equivalently vary the theory with respect to omega and E separately. And that actually is simple, because now vary the theory with respect to omega leads to nothing but partial free condition. And with variation with respect to E, give me modified Einstein equation. So I only need to look at what kind of modified Einstein equation you get. And it turns out the result is you find you get a nice term is not the Pauli field combination, unfortunately. It's h mu squared minus a half. And looks almost like a cosmological constant piece, but it's not quite a cosmological constant piece, because it's missing the linear. If you expand the cosmological constant, there's also a linear. And that's not here. So it looks like it's just a shift of cosmological constant and subtract a leading, you know, a first order piece. But in any case, what you end up with is the Einstein equation with a mass term with, that has a long coefficient. So this whole, this coefficient screws my story, basically. If this turned out to be one, that would be perfect, but obviously I didn't really expect it to happen. There would be too much miracle. So from the theory point of view, from the gravity theory point of view, I can sort of answer the question that the theory indeed contains the ghost. Okay, it's propagating 2 fine degrees freedom for one ghost, precisely because it's not a polyfield combination. So that's where the situation is at. There might be some other more games you can play with. Namely, there's Hochstab here. You know, maybe you can play with the background metric, make it more, you know, non-trivial, I don't know. And also, in this term, you can also modify this term. So you can introduce additional, yeah, okay. And there are several, there remains many games you can play with it, but so far I haven't been very successful in those directions. So thank you for your attention.
There's a paper by Stanley Gibbon that he had played with it. That he worked on the Townsend construction. He based his no-co theory.
Was it last year or something recently?
Yeah,
I think it's regarding this constant.
So construction.
I was trying to match that force theory into this language, but it doesn't really work very nicely. What you have is you have R squared terms, which can be written, you know, on the side. But if it happened to be F mu squared, that would be perfect, because then that's also a transonic term with a mass term with the normal connector for the gateway. That's also been studied by other people before. And we know precisely which range the theory has no ghosts and so on. But apparently it's not that deep. So
he's not right.
No, he might be right. He had F squared term, and then he also had the trace thing. If it's just Riemann R A P it just doesn't come out to be the right combination. It has this R squared term, the rich R squared term. It doesn't combine nicely into an F minus squared here. If it's just F minus squared here, then it would again be a null theorem. So that I haven't started that. I just heard it recently.
Well, what was the statement about who was wrong?
No, I didn't say they were wrong. I was saying if the theory happened to be, if I read everything in terms of the gate theory, if that it happens to be F minus squared plus less term plus a topologically, you know, plus a sine term, that theory has been studied by dozens of people before, which you know in which parameter range.
The thousand theory is simply the usual Einstein theory.
Right.
Plus 1 over m squared times r mini minus t over a times r squared.
It's a, I just looked at it. It's r mu nu squared minus 3 over a r squared.
That's right.
It's this coefficient that I cannot match.
Right.
Yeah. If it turns out, if you do if do f mu nu squared, it will be, well, it's very close, in fact. It's going to be a quarter. So I don't know what you can, what you can learn from there. Okay. So you see, there's only one eighth difference.
You said in the beginning that motivation was to try to learn something about 4D.
No. I was trying to learn why,
sure.
Why it's so difficult to linearly complete polyfields. If I can learn something in 3D, maybe I can.
No, fair enough. Fair enough. So I'm trying to say. So, did you see anything?
That's a coffee. That's it, guys. Speak again.